Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 29th, the year 2002, and Philip Mote starts a series, Global Climate Change, Truth and Consequences. And today's session is entitled, Are Humans Changing Global Climate? What Does Science Really Say? This is tape number MOP 2002-01. So now let's join Philip for today's session.
We're getting a large room full of people to be quiet. The person said very quietly, if you can hear me, clap once. And then a few people clap once. And then if you can hear me, clap twice. And it sort of ripples through the room. You are all very attentive. Thank you. I'm Philip Mote. I'm a scientist at the University of Washington. My background is in atmospheric sciences. And I want to take you through a problem of global climate change, not just the science that I am qualified to talk about, but also things I'm not qualified to talk about, like the economics and policy and theology of climate change. So in a minute, I'll just give you an outline of where I'm going this week. But first, I've got a little remote here. Let's hear what people are saying about this problem and the spin they put on it. President Clinton, in his last State of the Union address, said climate change is the environmental issue of the 21st century. Senator Chuck Hagel, in September 1997, this said there's very little that will impact the future of the world. And he says economically, politically, foreign policy, you name it, more than the issue of global climate change. Paul O'Neill, who was then president of Alcoa Aluminum Company, said, if we're wrong about global warming or nuclear holocaust, we won't get a second chance. It's that important. We have to do it right the first time. Anybody know what job he has right now?
Secretary.
That's right. He's Secretary of the Treasury, and one of a handful of administration officials who really understands this issue. And then, of course, there's Alfred E. Newman. Anybody remember that magazine? What Me Worry? So this is a sort of prevailing attitude, and it's easy to pick on the administration. But in fact, this really, I think, characterizes a lot of people in America today. So let me go over how I've outlined these five talks, and I'm not expecting that you'll all come up to all five of them, but this will show you what you're missing if you are not at all five of them. Today I'm going to talk about the science that addresses these questions. Are humans changing global climate? What does science really say about climate change? On Wednesday, we've got a slightly different schedule because there's a barbecue or something happening, so we have a different dinner schedule. What impacts would climate change have? That's, again, some more science. Then Thursday, we get into the moral and ethical dimensions of climate change, and we'll look at some Bible verses that have some bearing on it. Then what I've titled the morass, economic and policy dimensions, how the human race has grappled not with the science, but with the way to design approaches that would address this problem. And then finally, if you're still here on Saturday morning, come for the good news about how this is a problem that we can actually solve. I have asked for two books to be stocked in the bookstore. I may have underestimated the interest in this issue. There are only about five copies of each. The Stormy Weather is written by a guy I know, Patrick Mazza. It's called 101 Solutions to Climate Change, and it goes through some very simple everyday things you can do. This is the kind of thing we'll get into Saturday. And then a fascinating book called The Carbon War, which is sort of an inside account from somebody who initially represented the fossil fuel industry and eventually found himself working for Greenpeace because he felt so passionately about this issue. And talking about the negotiations that went on among the scientists and the policymakers, and especially the lobbyists for the oil industry and the coal industry. Fascinating glimpse into the behind-the-scenes workings. So let's look, first of all, let me just introduce my group so that you understand a little more. I work for the Climate Impacts Group at the University of Washington, which has as a goal to improve natural resource management and planning through research into how climate affects the things in the Northwest. And we have two definitions of the Northwest. One is Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, a political definition. The other is an ecological definition, the Columbia River Basin outlined in red. And either way, here in Holden, we sit squarely in the Pacific Northwest. And I'll get to some Northwest specific issues later, because I have discovered in my conversations with people up here that, contrary to my expectation that three quarters of the people would be from Minnesota, three quarters of them seem to be from within 50 miles of Portland. So today I put a little more of a Northwest focus into what I had prepared last week. So let's dive into the science. I'm going to skim through these. Don't worry, this is not a 10-hour lecture course. I'm just going to skim through, first of all, how we do the science, how we come up with answers to questions like these. What are the basic physics of the greenhouse effect? What are greenhouse gases and what changes have already happened in these greenhouse gases? Is there any evidence that Earth is warming? Is there any evidence that humans are responsible for the warming? And then questions that may come up from things you may have read or seen on television: is our weather getting more extreme? And then to bring it home to the Northwest, I'll talk about some observed changes here. And finally, if you're a little bit skeptical, and you have every right to be, what about all this talk you hear about urbanization? Doesn't the growth of cities around weather stations make it impossible to determine what any long-term warming trend might be? Also, what about these satellite observations you sometimes hear about that seem to prove that Earth isn't warming? And how do we know that this isn't just a natural fluctuation in climate, perhaps driven by the sun? So I will address these as I go through here, but I wanted to acknowledge up front that there's some valid questions that people sometimes ask about this issue, and I will leave time at the end, I promise, for a lot of questions. So, let's get started. How do we know what we know? We need to go back up one there. Thank you. Science operates by the medium of peer-reviewed papers. That is the gold standard. If you can do some research and get it published, that is a genuine contribution. And you can think of these papers as bricks of knowledge. And every year there are hundreds of peer-reviewed scientific papers, and so we've now accumulated thousands of papers, each of which has something to say about climate change. Putting all those bricks into a useful building, like say a schoolhouse or a church, requires a job of kind of assembling the bricks, making them fit together. And for the issue of climate change, unlike any other issue in the world, there's been massive effort by scientists to fit all these bricks together. And it comes under the aegis of what's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a really thrilling acronym that's unpronounceable, IPCC. And you may imagine intergovernmental meaning a bunch of government bureaucrats and panel, maybe 10 or 12 of them sitting around a room. These are very misleading terms. In fact, there have been several thousand people involved in these over the course of the several assessments, and so it's not a panel in the usual sense of a word. It is intergovernmental only in that governments agreed that they would listen to what the scientists said. They first issued a major report in 1990, and the third assessment report came out last year. The IPCC, which I will refer to frequently, because it is such a massive effort that it is authoritative, has three working groups. The first focused on the scientific basis. How do we know what we know about whether climate is changing, that sort of thing. That's what I'll talk about today. The second working group focuses on impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. That's what I'll talk about next on Wednesday. And then finally, on Saturday, I will cover some of what working group three said. mitigation, or how do we kind of slow down climate change if we want to. So that's how we know what we know. Let me go over just really briefly the physics of the greenhouse effect. Most of the atmosphere is made up of nitrogen and oxygen. These are molecules with just two atoms in them. This will become important in a moment. Earth receives energy from the sun and it reflects some of it, but the amount of energy that is absorbed has to equal the amount that goes out, otherwise there will be an imbalance and the temperature will change rapidly to restore the balance. So you can think very simply, this is the only equation you'll see tonight. Solar energy in has to equal the infrared energy out. Now the fact that these two types of energy have different wavelengths, solar energy has much shorter wavelengths, means that different gases can stop infrared energy without stopping solar energy. And those gases are what we call greenhouse gases. Nitrogen and oxygen are transparent to both solar and infrared, so that means they have nothing to do with this equation. They do not affect it at all. But if you affect the amount of infrared absorption, then the planet is not emitting as much as it should, so it has to warm up to compensate. There is a natural greenhouse effect, there's no doubt about that. It's been around for billions of years, and there's no question that this balance is affected by these greenhouse gases. What is in, so I've listed here some of them. Water vapor, the most important, cycles through the atmosphere very rapidly, and we consider that part of the response of the climate system. It's not something humans are directly doing, so I won't say anything more about water vapor. Carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide are all greenhouse gases. They trap heat, so they affect the temperature. And the thing that we'll discover shortly is that human activities have unquestionably increased the concentrations of all of these major greenhouse gases. So let's see the evidence for that. If I'm remembering correctly, that's what's next. Here is a reconstruction of the average carbon dioxide amounts. These are taken from little bubbles of gas trapped in ice in Greenland and Antarctica. They drill down through the ice, take it back to a lab in Denver, and look at the gas in the ice. And you see that from about AD 900, can anybody name anything that was happening in European history in AD 900?
Alfred the Great.
Was he around then? Okay. Anyway, yeah, so this was, you know, the Vikings were having fun back then. This was a very long time ago, and you notice that for several hundred years, this value stayed very close to 280 parts per million. Very carefully calibrated carbon cycle. Natural inputs and the natural outputs of carbon were very closely balanced. And then the human race in the 18th century started burning coal. Very little bit at first, and it didn't have much effect, but as the 19th century wore on, you see the carbon dioxide started to accumulate as we burned first coal and then oil and natural gas, all of which were taking carbon out of Earth's crust that had been there for millions of years and were suddenly putting it in the atmosphere. So there's no question that this increase is because of human activity, and the carbon dioxide amount has increased 32%. Half of that increase has occurred just since about 1960. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I expect that most of you were already around in 1960. And so just think about, since 1960, the human race has done half of the job of changing carbon dioxide of the entire record here. Let's look at another greenhouse gas, methane. Same kind of picture. Very stable at about 700 parts per million up until about the 18th century, started to creep up and then accelerated very rapidly in the 20th century. In the case of methane, it is more than doubled. It's up 150%. And this has to do not so much with burning oil and coal, but with methane, with rice paddies and other kinds of wet cultivation, termites, a lot of natural sources, but also clearly man-made sources that have changed the balance. I could show you a bunch more graphs like this, but I think you get the picture. We have unquestionably changed the quantities of very important gases in the atmosphere. And the question is, what will happen? We're doing an experiment on our planet, an almost unimaginable experiment. So what is going to happen? Well, I'll come to what's going to happen in my next talk. Question?
Along here, you've talked about getting this information from coring down into old ice.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you getting it here?
Well, a lot of these ice core measurements continue right up to within 20 years, but for carbon dioxide since 1956 and for methane since a little more recently, they've actually taken flasks of air directly from the atmosphere. Mauna Loa at the top of Hawaii is a popular location because you can be pretty sure that the air is relatively unaffected by it. It turns out for these gases, it doesn't matter whether you're close to a city or not. It's pretty similar, but they do try to get clean air. Yeah.
What does methane do to the climate?
Well, it's a greenhouse gas like carbon dioxide, and it's not quite as abundant, but molecule per molecule, it's about 200 times as effective as carbon dioxide. So if you had your choice of emitting a carbon dioxide molecule or a methane molecule, it'd be better to emit a carbon dioxide molecule. Yes.
And how does a rice paddy make methane gas?
Methane is produced by anoxic fermentation. So it's basically, whenever you don't have oxygen available, instead of producing carbon dioxide, it produces methane. So cows and other ruminants produce it in their stomachs, where they're digesting things without oxygen. Rice paddies and peat bogs and landfills all produce methane because stuff is decomposing without oxygen.
Okay, you say that the carbon dioxide is up 32% and the methane is up 150%. How has the population of the world increased during that time period?
I don't remember offhand, but I've seen a marvelous plot that shows carbon dioxide concentration versus population, and it's almost a straight line. As we've gotten more, and I'll get to some of this on later in the week, but as we get more prosperous, we've also tended to be more efficient. So those two things have kind of gone to sort of canceled each other out and leaving population as the major driver. Let's move on and look at some of the climate observations. So I want to describe evidence that Earth is warming. And really, a lot of these things are new in the last few years, and they have not completely percolated out into the public eye. So some of this may seem a little surprising, but it's taken together, it's a powerful statement. First of all, as I'll show in a minute, the global average surface temperature is up 6/10 of a degree Celsius, or a little over 1 degree Fahrenheit, over the last 100 years. These are measurements taken from thermometers. And next time you have a chance, step outside the snack bar over there, and there's a little weather station there. It's just a white box with a thermometer in it, and that is an example of weather stations that are in existence all over the world. And the problem with making a record like this that I'll show in a moment is that these instruments were never designed for long-term records. You know, we like to look at the chalkboard in there that says what yesterday's high was, and that's really interesting to us. And that's what that thermometer is for. But if we were to try to compare today's temperatures with the temperatures that the miners experienced 50 years ago, we'd want to know, was that thermometer well maintained the whole time? You might notice that the paint is peeling, so the box is a little darker than it should be. So it's going to be a little warmer because of that. You might want to know, does it still get the same amount of sun and shade that it used to get? Maybe those trees grew up around it. And there are a lot of questions like that that you have to ask about each individual thermometer, because nobody was planning to monitor our climate. And even now that we have some notion that it might be changing, we don't have a good climate observing system. So instead, what scientists have had to do is only accept those weather records that keep careful documentation of things like tree growth, time of day that they're making the measurements, how the landscape around it has changed, and if the instruments have changed. So it's been a lot of work to put together this record of climate from thermometers. But fortunately, if we don't quite believe those, nature is telling us on its own what's happening. Permafrost throughout the Arctic is melting. Permafrost is a layer of frozen soil, and as it warms up, it melts. Arctic ice is thinning and shrinking, and you probably heard that the Antarctic ice shelves are breaking up because of the warming. They're at that sensitive point where the ice is no longer packed year-round. The frost-free season is longer in many places, and plants are blooming earlier in spring. If you take all these pieces of evidence together, it adds up to a real warming. It can't just be brushed off as urbanization or something else. And in fact, the IPCC said there is new and stronger evidence that there has been substantial warming in the last 50 years. So let's look first at the thermometer record. This goes back to 1860, and each year is one vertical bar. And you can see that for much of the 19th century, there wasn't a whole lot of warming. And then there was a pulse of warming early in the 20th century, and then it didn't keep warming. It cooled down slightly to about the mid-70s, and then it started climbing again. In a minute, I will describe attempts that scientists have made to understand these changes and why it hasn't just kind of gone up with the carbon dioxide and the methane. But it's pretty clear that it has warmed up, according to the thermometers. Well, what about the distribution of this warming? This is a kind of a funny map of dots. The size of the dot indicates the magnitude of the warming trend, and the red dots are warming, the blue dots are cooling. So you can see there are a few areas, North Atlantic and a couple places in Africa and China, that have cooled, but by and large over the 20th century, just about everywhere will warm. And you can see there are big blank areas in the southern hemisphere, and in fact over the southern ocean you just get these few areas corresponding to ship tracks. And it's unfortunate, again, that we didn't have a better climate observing system in the southern hemisphere. But what evidence there is does seem to indicate the southern hemisphere was warming, too. You'll notice that some of the largest dots are up here in Siberia and the Arctic. And this is another argument that urbanization is not driving. People are not moving to those places. Okay, let's go on. How many of you have been to Mount Rainier? Most of you. Beautiful volcano, Washington State. Got more shoulders than Mount Hood in Oregon. If you drive up to Paradise, you would cross a bridge right about here. And this is where the Nisqually Glacier ended in 1895. The end of this glacier is now more than a mile up the river valley. And we know about that because of these photographs. And most of the retreat of the glacier has happened in the last 40 years. Now, this is just one glacier. What are other glaciers saying? Well, the IPCC collected many dozens of glacial records, and this just summarizes 20 of them, shown here all the way from Svalbard in about 80 degrees north latitude, down to Patagonia, and including some tropical glaciers too, in Irian-Jaya and Mount Kilimanjaro. And for all of these, you see that as you go through time, they tend to be fairly stable. Then you get to about 1900, and they start declining. So most glaciers around the world are receding, and we know that that's generally because of temperature, not precipitation. You can find a few exceptions here in New Zealand and in Norway, where the glaciers have turned around, but those correspond with areas where it's been raining cats and dogs, and that's contributed to more volume of the glaciers. So generally, the glaciers are consistent with a global warming trend. I mentioned that spring is coming earlier. This may excite you gardeners. This is a figure that I got from some colleagues at UC San Diego. Again, it's a dots used to tell a story. In this case, the dot shows a stream where the spring pulse of snowmelt
has been coming either earlier or later. The blue dots are where spring has been coming later, and you can see that in most of the West, spring has been coming earlier, and in some cases by as much as 40 days. And this is just a trend over the last 50 years. And you can see Washington is pretty well blanketed by these red dots. I've been looking at some snow records, and they're very consistent with this story. Okay, what about those satellite measurements? Let's address that for a moment, because it fits in with this picture. Satellite observations. First of all, there have been a series of 9 satellites, and scientists have had to sort of graft their records on one to the next, and they only started in 1979, so we're really only talking about the last 23 years. Climate models, which I'll say more about in a moment, say that the troposphere, that's the layer of the atmosphere where there's weather and clouds and so on, that the troposphere should be warming faster than the surface. But satellites show little warming over the bottom layer of the troposphere, 0 to 5 miles. And you saw that picture with the empty southern hemisphere. Satellites can observe the whole Earth, so we don't have to worry about whether there was a ship sailing through there or not. And if you look at the satellite record here, that's the thick black line here, you can see that indeed over the last 23 years there has not been an appreciable warming. You can see the big El Nino event here that pumped a lot of heat into the atmosphere, but then that heat mostly went away again. So you draw a straight line through this and you say, no trend. Well, let's go back earlier in the record using balloons. Balloon measurements have been taken to support weather forecasting operations twice a day throughout the world, and we can use those balloon records to match what the satellite was doing. And so let's look here during the time when they overlap. There are very few times when they're saying anything different happened. They track each other very closely. So we can probably believe both the satellites and the balloon measurements, going up and down together. Well, look what the balloons did just before the first satellite was launched. It said that the 1960s and 70s were a lot cooler. So apparently, the atmosphere, the troposphere, warmed up quite a lot just in time for the satellites to start watching, and then there hasn't been much warming since then. So if you draw a longer record, the warming roughly matches the surface measurements, which are shown here in gray. But again, there was a bit of a cooling during the 60s. So it's sort of a complicated story here, but the main message is that the satellites do not contradict the notion that the surface of the Earth is warming. They are looking at a layer there, and if anything is wrong, it's that the models seem to have too simple a picture of how global warming should proceed. So that's the satellites. Now, fine, you say. Maybe it's warming up, but it's warmed up in the past, it's cooled off in the past. We know that there were big ice ages. If you're from Wisconsin or Minnesota, you know that 10,000 years ago, that land was under a mile of ice. So how do we know that anything's different this time? Well, first of all, the rate of warming is unusual, and I'll show that in a minute. Next, the explanations people have tried to make fit with the observations don't work for natural explanations. Finally, the amount of warming that we've gotten is roughly consistent with what we expect from laboratory studies of how air should behave if you increase the carbon dioxide by 30%. So this is consistent with basic physics. All right, here's what's called the hockey stick diagram. This is a reconstruction from AD 1000 to about the mid-60s, and that's what's shown in blue, of the northern hemisphere average temperature. Now, if we had trouble coming up with a story over the last 140 years, given the kinds of weather observations we started with, imagine how difficult it was for scientists to reconstruct a 1,000-year record. They're using tree rings and corals and other what are called proxy measurements that give a glimpse of what might have been happening, and they all have to be carefully calibrated. This is the most ambitious study to date using all these different proxies, and it tells a story of remarkable climate stability from AD 1000 to about 1900. And then it starts to take off, and in red are shown the thermometer observations that I showed you earlier, and you can again see the sort of two pulses of warming. 1998, the last year on this record, was far warmer than anything else that this suggests in the last 2,000 years, and quite probably it's the warmest since the last glacial maximum 120,000 years ago. This figure might look suspiciously like the one I showed you for carbon dioxide. And indeed, there is a striking resemblance in the shape of this. Remarkable stability up to 1900, and then a rapid acceleration. So that's one piece of evidence that humans might be responsible. We've clearly changed the atmosphere. The climate system seems to be responding, maybe in a bit of a jerky fashion, but it does seem to be responding. Another piece of evidence comes from experiments with climate models. I've shown here in red, again, the observed temperature records for the last 160 years. And now, in gray, I've shown some experiments that climate modelers have done using what's called forcings. You can imagine a climate model, a very complicated computer program, sort of like a weather prediction model. And it's got different knobs on it. And you can play around with these knobs, all these different ways that things can influence climate, and see what happens. I ran a summer school 4 years ago, a two-week school, on climate modeling. And we had the students pick their own ideas for what to do with climate models. And it was fascinating to see what they came up with. One group decided to take out all the mountains and just make the world flat, like Eastern Washington. Well, Eastern Washington isn't completely flat. Like the Central Valley of California, though, that's a flat place. Another group decided to turn off the sun and just see how long it took for things to get really abysmally cold. And there was a bit of an irony with that experiment. We had rented a bunch of Sun microcomputers to run these climate models on. And somebody inadvertently turned off the computer that was running the turn off the sun. Well, these are all, you know, sort of nice, funny experiments to do. Another group, I think, had the Earth rotating backwards. But we are indeed, as I said, conducting an experiment on our planet. And so why not take these climate models and run the same experiment on them that we're doing on our climate? So in this case, this top left diagram shows what happens when you run a climate model just with the changes in solar forcing and volcanic eruptions that were observed over the last 140 years. And so you can see here some dips in the simulated climate in 1963, I think it was, when Mount Agung erupted. Again in 1982, when El Chichon in Mexico erupted. In 1991, when Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted. Each of those caused a brief cooling, and then over a period of a few years, the climate recovered. So you see those spikes, and in fact, they do line up with cooling events in the observed global climate record, which tells us two things. One, we know roughly how much volcanoes influence climate, and two, the climate models can do a pretty good job of responding when we hit them with this kind of problem. It turns out that solar forcing has not changed appreciably over the last 30 years, other than the regular 11-year solar cycle. So that has not had much influence on our climate. And in fact, if anything, the volcanic eruptions and the slight decline in solar forcing over the last 50 years would have given us a cooling. So we have a puzzle. Nature would have produced cooling, but we saw warming. So what's missing from this simulation? It's the human influence. So that's what you see here in the right hand. Here, they've taken the same climate model. They've left the sun and the volcanoes out of it. The sun is just blazing away constantly. But they've cranked up the carbon dioxide and the methane, and they've also done some other stuff that humans have done, which I won't get into unless you want to hear about it. And you see that the climate would have been fairly stable up to about 1950, and then the accumulation of greenhouse gases starts to have an effect, and we see this warming that's been observed of about 1 degree Fahrenheit. So if you put all of these influences together, you get this bottom diagram. And I think you'd agree this is a remarkable simulation of Earth climate over the last 140 years, with some of the ups and downs. And it suggests that this early century warming was possibly natural, and the late century warming was quite likely human influence. There have been many other studies using different approaches that are more complicated than this, but they tend to come up with the same conclusion. The last 50 years bear the influence of human activity on global climate. Okay, so let's say, all right, so maybe our climate is changing. What about our weather? Is our weather getting more extreme? Let me say something about perception, detection, and attribution. If you just sort of think back on your life and on weather events you remember, you probably remember, you know, that time it snowed 3 feet and you woke up in the morning and you didn't have to go to school. Or the time when it was really hot for a month and your garden died because you just couldn't keep up with it. Well, it would be very difficult to take those perceptions and determine whether there was an actual trend in extreme events. In fact, it's pretty difficult even to take robust weather records and determine whether there's a trend. So this notion of perception, we really sort of have to leave that out of it. And detection is an issue of statistics. If you've got a wiggly line, how can you tell whether there's a trend in it? And then, let alone, how can you say that this is related to climate change? As I showed, we can now say that humans have changed the global average temperature, but we can't yet say that humans have changed the incidence of typhoons, or the amount of precipitation, or really anything else. So this issue of attribution, of assigning causes to things that have changed, is still a very difficult challenge for science. The IPCC said that trends in most extreme events, like hurricanes, floods, thunderstorms, have not been detected. The exceptions are extreme precipitation events in the US, which are increasing, and extreme cold events are decreasing. How many of you are from Minnesota? So you probably recognize that in the last 10 years, there have been far fewer of those really deeply cold winters that used to be characteristic. And it turns out the central part of North America is one of these places where winter temperatures are really going up fast. And I leave it to you to decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. On Wednesday, we'll talk about the impacts of climate change on whether, you know, what are the goods and bads about climate change. But for all of these extreme events, it's impossible to say this change is definitely related to human activity. At this point, scientists are not ready to say that. So environmental groups love to say, boy, remember Hurricane Mitch devastated Central America? That was global warming. Gotta stop global warming. And us scientists are sitting on the sidelines saying, whoa, wait a minute. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. We'll never know, and you shouldn't say that. Weather-related insurance claims have been skyrocketing, and the insurance industry is very concerned about global climate change because they don't like the idea that all of these insured losses could be increasing. And so they've been very active in the climate change debate internationally. But it turns out that in the US, this trend in claims is entirely because we've been building our houses in places where hurricanes are more likely to hit, like South Carolina and Florida, and building in floodplains along the river valleys. So it turns out that when you subtract for these trends in where the money is going, there has been no change in the extreme events themselves. Which also says something about the intelligence of the human race, but we'll get into that later too. All right, I'm going to bring it down to the Northwest. This is a dot map of weather stations, climate stations in the Northwest. Each dot, again, shows one station. And the filled dots show warming trends. The open dots show cooling trends. And in the state of Washington, there are only two stations, Odessa and Colfax, that show a cooling trend over the last 80 years. And in Idaho, there are a few more. In Oregon, there are several, including Crater Lake here, which has seen a fairly large cooling trend of about 1 degree Fahrenheit. But you also see a lot of big dots. Challis, Idaho, again, not a place a lot of people are moving. Konkanoli, Washington, population 345, largest warming trend in Washington state. And Mackenzie Bridge Ranger Station in Oregon, still got one person living there. And in fact, as you look at the populated areas in Western Washington, Western Oregon, you don't see a lot of much bigger dots than elsewhere. And if you do a careful regional averaging, you come up with 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit warming per century. So it's a little faster than the global average. And let's take a quick look at precipitation. You notice, first off, that there are far fewer stations. In Canada, for some reason, it's just the opposite. I've been looking at Canadian records to try to extend this map north of the 49th parallel. They've got loads of precipitation stations and far fewer temperature stations. But again, most of the dots are dark, indicating an increasing trend. And the regional average is about a 14% increase, with some of these stations on the dry side over here being very large percentage increases. So the Northwest is getting warmer and wetter. And it's also seems to be losing snowpack. This is the snow depth that's Snoqualmie Pass, Washington, which if you drove here from Seattle or possibly even Portland, depending on the route you took, you probably went over Snoqualmie Pass. They've been taking depth measurements twice a month since the 1920s, and if you draw a straight line through there, you find this decline in snow depth. Now remember, the precipitation is going up. So the only way we can get a decline in the depth is for the temperature to be turning some of the snow into rain. And as I said, I'm looking at more snow records to see whether this is broadly true around the Northwest, but it seems to be consistent with the warming. So I think, yes, let's wrap up. Earth is certainly warming. There's no longer any doubt about the fact that it's warming. It's probably warming faster than at any time in the 10,000 years that humans have had something approximating civilization. The whole time the Bible was written, all the way through recorded history, climate has been fairly stable, and we're now pushing it beyond that envelope in which our species populated the Earth. It's quite probable that the warming that we see is because of human activity. And I showed you the greenhouse gas accumulation and how that matched up with the temperature reconstruction and also these attempts to simulate climate with climate models. The Northwest is getting warmer and wetter, and that seems to be translating into less snowpack, at least at moderate elevation sites like Snoqualmie Pass. And on Wednesday, I'll say a bit more about where that might start to show up in economic and ecological things that you care about. And I think that's okay. So come back Wednesday for a glimpse of the future. So far, I've only talked about the past. I'd be happy to take questions. Yes?
Other than the theories of human population, what is the evidence that the greenhouse gases are causing the increase in temperature rather than the increase in temperature causing the greenhouse gases?
Well, first of all, we know that we know without a doubt that those gases have gone up because of what humans have done. Let me give you an example. There are sufficiently detailed inventories of coal and oil consumption that we can go back in history and add up how much was burned. And in fact, what we find is that only half of what was burned accumulated in the atmosphere. Nature has managed to absorb the other half, roughly. roughly evenly divided between the ocean and the land. Second, and this is one piece, one example of how far the science has come in recent years, a guy I met in college who has gone on to fame and fortune had the idea to take measurements of oxygen. Now, can you, I guess we can leave this dark. Turns out that even though there's vastly more oxygen than carbon dioxide, several hundred thousand times as much, if you have very sensitive measurements, you can detect the oxygen going down as carbon dioxide, as fossil fuels are burned. And if you compare the rates of change of those two, you can actually do a very careful budget of how much went into the ocean, how much went into the atmosphere, and how much the fossil fuels, how much went into the ocean, how much went into land, and how much went into the atmosphere through constraints on the chemistry. Finally, isotope ratios have been used to fingerprint those molecules that were dug up from the ground and again to track where they went. So it's very clear that the increase in carbon dioxide and methane is because of human activity. As we go back in time, hundreds of thousands of years, the relationship between those two is not as clear, and it's not quite so clear how they related in glacial interglacial cycles that are much longer, but clearly this time it's carbon dioxide drawing temperature.
Oh, what about deforestation?
Deforestation is important too. It's a, I've only talked about greenhouse gas changes, but of the total human influence on carbon dioxide, about a quarter comes from deforestation. The other three quarters are fossil fuels, and incidentally, cement production. When you dig that stuff up and grind it, it's releasing CO2.
One of your slides earlier showed that volcanic activity produced cooling.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, a really big volcanic eruption in the tropics punches enough ash into the stratosphere that it'll stay there. Mount St. Helens and other and Alaskan volcanoes, for one thing, they tend to erupt sideways. So they aren't really lofting a lot of stuff up. But even if they do loft stuff up, the stratosphere is sinking at these latitudes. And so pretty quickly it's flushed out. But in the tropics, there's this gentle rising motion. So these ash particles just sort of sit there for years. And they reflect sunlight. So as long as they're there, they're reflecting sunlight. But eventually, after a few years, they too settle out.
The ocean's often referred to as a carbon sink that's helping to buffer all this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a saturation point at some point soon? Or
not soon. In the IPCC report where they talk about the future of the carbon cycle, it's very clear that the biggest net change, or the biggest unknown in future CO2, is how much we're going to put up there. The ocean and the land are going to absorb some amount, but nowhere near as much as we're putting up there. There are scenarios that the buffering capacity of the ocean would diminish with time for a number of reasons, including the fact that the solubility of carbon dioxide in water goes down as temperature goes up. So right now the tropics are putting CO2 in because they've got more CO into the atmosphere because they've got more CO2 dissolved in them than they can hold. High latitudes are taking it out. As you warm the whole ocean, that balance changes, and so you could get a net loss in CO2 buffering. But most of what goes on with carbon dioxide is driven by biology. It's driven by plankton, which essentially sucks CO2 out of the ocean, which then sucks it out of the air. So that life maintains a big disequilibrium. Still unknown how that's going to play out.
You sort of alluded to this in one of your earlier answers, but if you go back in the geologic record, we know that there have been ice ages and
mm-hmm.
huge planetary fluctuations in temperature. Most of your data went back to the year 1000 or somewhere around there. So when you look back further in time, how do we know that this temperature change isn't part of a normal fluctuation of...
Right. First of all, let me describe what we know about these ice age cycles. B- before about a million years ago, there was no fluctuation between glacial and interglacial periods. Earth did other things, but we didn't have large amounts of ice covering the planet. We know that they've happened roughly every 100,000 to 120,000 years in the last million years, so there have been something like seven or eight cycles. And we know that the carbon dioxide and methane tend to go with temperature. And it's thought that it's not simply CO2 goes up and then temperature goes up, but that there's some complex set of feedbacks possibly involving what happens when you lower sea level and expose land areas, that you can then get more drawdown of CO2. This is still very, very much unknown. But what is clear is that on those time scales, CO2 varies between, and it's very regular between a glacial and an interglacial, between 280 parts per million, which remember was the amount that prevailed before the industrial period, very stable at 280, and 200. So that difference between a glacial and an interglacial in carbon dioxide, bear with me here, that's 80. We are now at 370, which is a difference of 90. So we've already bumped, number one, we've bumped the CO2 up more than an ice age does. Number two, if we go back in the records, anybody want to guess how far back you have to go to find CO2 that was at present day values?
Dinosaurs.
Back to dinosaurs. You're pretty close. The dinosaurs died 65 million years ago, and the best evidence is that you have to go back 20 million years before you find carbon dioxide this high. So we know that this time the composition of the atmosphere is very different than it has been throughout this glacial-interglacial cycle. And so it's pretty clear that that's not part of that natural cycle. Yes.
Could you speak to the scientific community's opinion of hybrid cars?
I will get to that on Saturday when I talk about what we could be doing about this.
I've heard that the glaciers melting in Alaska are adding inches of water to the worldwide ocean, and that's going on at an accelerated rate. Do you have information on that?
Yeah. And there was, I think you're referring to a paper that came out fairly recently and got some press. The IPCC has done a marvelous job of collecting a lot of different studies about what contributes to sea level rise. Over the last 100 years, sea level has gone up, I think, about 20 centimeters, about 8 inches. And the projection is that in the next 100 years, it will go up by about 40 centimeters or 20 inches. We know very little about where this sea level rise has come from, but there are two main factors. One is the melting of land ice, like the glaciers in Alaska and all the other glaciers I've showed, and Antarctica and Greenland, which are much bigger. And also the thermal expansion of the oceans. As seawater warms, it gets slightly bigger, and so you think about the whole world ocean warming up, and it only has to expand by 0.01%, and you've got, you're wiping out Guam and things like that. So the very small amount of thermal expansion contributes. There are huge unknowns, and Antarctica is probably the biggest unknown, how much it's changed and how it's going to change in the future. We're finally starting to monitor it with airborne lasers and things like that. Yes?
I read something a couple years ago about
I'll pay attention to the balcony next time.
If enough ice melted at a certain place, that a big ice sheet would fall into the ocean and then raise it dramatically higher.
Yeah, this is one of those sort of scary scenarios that was floated by a scientist wondering and then subsequently completely discredited by scientists. The way Antarctica flows, these rivers of ice, think about, hot fudge sauce or something. They flow like rivers, and if you warm them up, they flow faster. But this idea that the Western Antarctic ice sheet would become unstable and just sort of all flow into the ocean is now viewed as an extremely low probability event, and if it did happen, it would take at least 500 years to raise sea level by 20 feet. So we don't need to worry about that one, I don't think. Yes?
To what extent are you speaking for Philip Rowe? To what extent are you speaking for the scientific community in your field?
Yeah, I have tried very hard to use only the statements and figures that are accepted by the full IPCC. And so that's a body of about 600 climate scientists who wrote this big report, and then a group of about 30 of them wrote the condensed version for policymakers, and the figures that I showed are mostly from that. So I would say that if anybody from the IPCC were here, they would agree with everything I said. When I got to the part about the Pacific Northwest, that's work that we've done at SIG, and so that's, you know, of a lesser, it's been less thoroughly peer-reviewed.
Are there other scientists who are not signing on to this?
There are about eight people who claim to have climate credentials who would say no, Earth is not warmed. No, actually, very few of them would even say Earth is not warmed anymore. There are a handful, and I mean you see them on the same, you know, congressional testimonies and TV shows and newspaper articles, and I could list you all their names. Some of them have genuine credentials, like Dick Linson and Pat Michaels, and those two do agree that Earth is warmed. They dispute the cause, the attribution of cause. But yeah, there are really very few anymore who would disagree with what I'm saying. There are some who would think I was too cautious. Yes.
Do they work for George Bush?
No.
That really wasn't
my faculty at the university.
Why is it a failure or lack of whatever on the scientific community, or is it the media, or is it that Americans don't want to know, or what would you say is the reason for this idea not being accepted more?
Well, first of all, there's a perception that much of this is still under debate in the scientific community, and I think the IPCC tried very hard in this last assessment report to lay that to rest, that there's really no controversy anymore about whether Earth is warming. There's still some about whether we can attribute that to human activity, but I think the IPCC said it was about 90% likely that the warming we've seen is attributed to can be attributed to human activity. Scientists, but there are a number of factors at work, and it's interesting you bring that up. Scientists tend to want to be known as people who are always right. And to be always right, I mean, it's okay to be wrong and then admit you're wrong, but they tend to want to maintain credibility by not saying things that are not demonstrably true. Not going out on a limb, so to speak. Not doing something like giving a weather forecast for 2 weeks from now. You know, it's impossible. So they tend to couch all the terms in these very broad, you know, it could be from this to this. And that just sounds really fuzzy to people. But when, you know, when I say on Wednesday, it looks like global average temperature in the next 100 years will probably go up at least 3 degrees Fahrenheit and as much as 10 degrees Fahrenheit, that's a really broad range. And so you can sort of go away saying, oh, only 3 degrees, so that sounds pretty good, you know, nothing to worry about. Or you can think, gads, you know, 10, that's terrible. The media tends to take these disagreements that scientists have about whether it's going to be 3 or 10, or, you know, the handful who say, ah, no warming at all. And it makes much more of a story if you can find controversy. So I think in the last couple of years, most media have realized that it's no longer appropriate to give equal time to the one scientist who has this point of view when 99 others have the other point of view. And you've given equal time to those two. So there has been a shift in the media in recent years, and I think it'll take a while for the public to catch on. But I've seen polls that say 70% of Americans believe that humans are changing the climate. So maybe it's no longer a matter of people having enough scientific understanding. But I'll get to that on.
Isn't there also politics in the oil industry and, you know, major companies?
Oh, yes. And that's what this book goes into great detail about. And I'll say a little bit on Thursday, Friday or something. I'll take one more question.
I just want to know what, when methane gas is burned, what is the result of methane gas?
Yeah, if you burn methane, you get carbon dioxide and water. So that's better than releasing the methane. Your natural gas, if you have a gas stove or a gas heater, that burns methane. And provided the natural gas pipeline doesn't leak, that's a really good way to use energy. It's better than coal by a long shot. Much more efficient. You're still producing CO2 the way you are if you're burning coal, but much less of it for a given amount of heat. I think I'd better close now, and I'll take questions informally after those who want to go.